thank you for tuning in to The Healthy Debate. My name is Lindy Nocton. Our aim with this programme, produced by Health Freedom Ireland in conjunction with the Irish Inquiry, is to promote debate on issues relating to health in Ireland. We have to emphasise all the time that we have no agenda beyond trying to examine all sides of an argument so that you, the public, can make up your own minds about what to do about your health and indeed your lives. Much of the material you see on this programme is not available through mainstream channels, who today told us we're all insane, actually. And so we'd appreciate it if you can support us and spread the word by pressing the share button on your screens. Now, tonight we have a special guest, Dr. Jane Donegan, who is 100% Irish, although living in London. She has an interesting story to tell us, not just about MMR, and other vaccines in general, but also about the dreaded CV Jackson injection in particular. But before we get on to Jane, we look onto what's been going on in the past week, which has been a particularly busy one. On Thursday last, or was it Wednesday, I can't remember now, our president signed off the legislation for vaccine passports. He had until Friday, but he did it, you know, pretty quickly. We had hoped he wouldn't, since this legislation drives a coach and four through our constitutional rights, and he has the power to refer dodgy laws to the Supreme Court. Unfortunately, he didn't in this case, which meant that from Monday, although indoor dining returned, it would only be open to those who could show a vaccine passport, whatever that is, because I don't have one. Please note, you don't have to prove that you are vaxxed. You just have to prove that you have a vaccine passport, and we'll refer to that later. There was also the ongoing and horrifying plan to vaccinate all children to protect them from a respiratory illness that's really not much different from all those other respiratory illnesses the human race has fought off for millennia. That battle continues, and indeed we may come back to it next week. The good news is that more and more people are realising from personal experience that this COVID-19 is nothing much to fear, and that many already have the vital T-cell immunity, which means that if you're pretty healthy, you'll get a miserable week or so and feeling rightly sorry for yourself, but there's nothing much more to it than that. There's other good news, which drugs like statins are now showing that they have some positive effect on COVID. So the repurposing of drugs is another story we may come back to in the future. Right, well, all over the world on Saturday, ordinary people took to the streets to let the governments of their countries know that we the people are on to them. They've lied to us for the past 16 months and we've had quite enough. In Dublin alone, about 15,000 marched from Custom House to Merrion Street, of where the government sits. Of course, the usual hotheads showed up, but largely they were ignored. Interestingly, among those who didn't turn up were mainstream journalists, with virtually all the main newspapers, radio and TV channels running the same agency story, and claiming that only 1,500 turned up, by the way. This morning, though, Fintan O'Toole got his spoke in by saying that anyone who doesn't take the vaccine in Ireland is either insane or, I forget what the other word, loony, I think was the word used. So those of us who are concerned about the health aspects of the clot jab, as they're calling it, or something like that, we're now lunatics. Despite that, we suspect some of the politicians were paying attention to the numbers that were out on the streets, also in Cork and other places around Ireland. On Monday, Leo Varadkar, the real Taoiseach, announced a long overdue change to how COVID cases are counted. He instructed hospitals not to count people who had come to the hospitals with other complaints and then subsequently tested positive. It's a start, even though we all know by now that a positive test is pretty meaningless. And some experts, in fact, this week again, are admitting that the PCR test can't distinguish between, say, a cold, a fever, pneumonia, or even the common cold. There was good news from abroad. In Spain, the Constitutional Court ruled that the coronavirus state of alarm was unconstitutional. And in Russia, the health passport largely became was abandoned because a large proportion of the population had found their ways around it, such as making up their own QR codes or making up names when they arrived at the door of some of the places where they were required to show them. Not that we're recommending any of these things. Many Russians had already had the magic jab, but like sensible human beings everywhere, they really didn't want the government knowing where they are and what they're doing all the time. They're also using cash because they don't want to know them to know what we're buying, which seems pretty sensible because that's what we're buying into, a state where through this vax passport, they will know everything about us. So that's this week's roundup. We'll now get into our chat with Jane Donegan. This evening we're speaking to Jane Donegan, who's a doctor. I think you're still a doctor.
I'm still a doctor, yes.
Of Irish extraction living in England. And Jane has her own particular story to tell us about vaccinations in general and the COVID vax in particular. So Jane, could you tell us about your history with in the wonderful world of vaccinations?
My history is that I used to think that vaccines were the best thing since sliced bread, although probably I've gone off sliced bread a bit since then, because I went through medical school where I was taught that, and this is for all vaccinations, I'm not talking about COVID now, I was taught that people used to die from all these diseases for which we now have vaccines. And then the vaccines came in and everybody stopped dying, and it was because of those. And nothing occurred to make me think differently as I finished my medical studies and started doing my postgraduate studies, which included paediatrics and obstetrics and gynaecology and various other things that I needed to do to become a general practitioner, although I did take an extra year doing orthopaedics and trauma. And in the 1980s, when I was doing community paediatrics, I used to counsel what we thought of then as the ghastly parents who didn't want to vaccinate their children with whooping cough vaccine, because at the end of the 70s and the early 80s, that was the problematic vaccine in those days. What I used to think, which was basically an opinion shared by most of my medical colleagues, was that if you didn't want to vaccinate your children, you were ignorant. And if you weren't ignorant, you were sociopathic, because otherwise, why would you want to withhold what we saw as this life-saving intervention? So my children were born in 91 and 93, and I wouldn't say I unthinkingly, I did with full forethought, knew I was doing the right thing, in my opinion then, had them vaccinated with what was available in the early 90s, which is a lot less than what's available now. And I even let them have a measles, mumps and rubella vaccine, even though as a child I had been taken with my parents to measles, mumps, rubella and chickenpox parties along with all of my peers in the holidays. So we'd get ill in the holidays and not miss school, which in my opinion was a form of child abuse, because the whole point of being ill is that you miss school. So that's how keen I was on vaccination, and I thought that all the science supported it. I even let them give my elder daughter an out-of-date BCG vaccination, which I noticed was out of date because automatically I scan vials when I see them. And I said, oh, excuse me, that's out of date. And she said, oh, yes, that's why the clinic was delayed for an hour, but we've spoken to the lab and it's fine. And she had a terrible, terrible reaction to it. And even then I just went on ahead and vaccinated her with whatever else was there up until the end of the first year. So what happened? So in 1994, there was a measles rubella campaign where in the UK we vaccinated 7 million school children with measles rubella vaccine. And we were notified by the chief medical officer that there was going to be a measles epidemic, and that all the people who'd had one measles vaccination, measles containing vaccination, would not necessarily be protected. Now, this didn't really worry me because nothing is 100%. But when they said, and in those days it was one shot for life, all you needed in your life was one measles shot. But then when they said, even if you'd had two measles vaccines, like maybe you'd had the single measles vaccine on its own, and then when the MMR came in, the MMR, which was supposed to boost your measles immunity, when this epidemic came, you still wouldn't be protected. And I thought to myself, you know, I've been saying to all these parents who have any queries about vaccination that, well, the thing about the vaccines is we're told that you're 10 times less likely to have a bad outcome, say from a vaccine adverse reaction, than you are from having the disease. So any sensible, responsible parent would give their child the vaccine. And now you're saying that you can have two shots of a one-shot vaccine, for which, in terms of adverse reactions, nobody in the whole world actually knows what the adverse reactions are to vaccines. Because since we've been giving them, and particularly since we started universal childhood immunization in the beginning of the 1960s, there has been no open, dedicated, egalitarian way of recording these. They're not recorded properly or systematically. They're recorded randomly, passively. Nobody just follows people up. Someone has to think, a parent has to think, my child had a vaccine. Maybe this thing that's happened now is due to the vaccine, because nobody says there's this big long list of things that might happen. Then you used to have to go to the doctor and say, I think this was caused by the vaccine. And then the doctor would say, don't be ridiculous, of course it wasn't, even if it was in the package insert. Since 1999, nurses have been able to send in these yellow cards in the UK. And since 2009, the public have been able to send in yellow cards because the doctors and nurses were failing so badly. So nobody really knows what the adverse reactions are. So basically, you have two shots of a one-shot vaccine and you still might get the disease. So in terms of whether you're a person who looks at balances or whether you're a gambler, it started to look slightly less obvious and slightly less black and white and more grey. And so initially, it wasn't really so much from the point of view of giving good information to my patients, but by now, my children were 1-year-old and 3-year-old, and I was thinking, well, oh my goodness, are they going to die? Which is a very strange thing to think, especially from the diseases for which I got sent to parties to get. But something happens when you go to medical school where your whole way of looking at things, or your Weltanschauung, changes, and things that you thought were ordinary now become sort of big bogey people. And so I thought, well, I just have to find out this information for my patients, but even more so for my children, because if these vaccines aren't working, then my children are going to die. And I often say to people, if you have a discussion with a healthcare professional and you come out and you're questioning what they want you to do, whether it's vaccination or drug or any other sort of intervention, and you come out feeling scared, that's because that's how they're actually feeling about the choice that you're talking about making. Because if you're a doctor and all you know about is what you learnt in medical school, you don't know a lot about health. Because at medical school, we don't learn about health. We learn about how all the basic functions of the body work in terms of physiology and anatomy. We learn about disease, and we cut up dead bodies, which is not really a way of learning how to be healthy. And it's the more holistic disciplines that actually look at fresh air, sunshine, light, and look at why we actually really get diseases, and the fact that maybe it's not all a big mistake if you get a fever.
Yes.
It might be actually a useful thing for the body to be doing because it's trying to unload itself of some stuff that needs to be got rid of. Those are not concepts we learn. And in terms of immunization, we spend hardly any time talking about that at all. And I must say that I would not be wrong to say that the majority of doctors who are the deliverers of the vaccination programs have never even read the package insert.
Well, so I completely agree with you there. And as we all know, I've done some research into housing policies in Dublin. And as we all know, that when sanitation improved, when nutrition improved, when people were given a bit more space in their environment, a lot of these seemingly rampant diseases just disappeared. And it was at that point that vaccinations, for some reason, the vaccinations only came along at that point. I don't actually understand that, but the diseases were already going. And then
they came in on the back of those. So I had heard things like what you had said from people who, like you, were not medical, or people who were doctors in America, like, what do they know, you know? Because I went to a top London medical school, and I had top London professors, and I had top London textbooks, and they all told me one story. And I thought, well, I have to find out what is the truth. And so I rang up the Office for National Statistics, because I noticed that in the green book, I don't know if you can see behind me, but there's a whole load of green books behind my finger. Green is short for Immunization Against Infectious Diseases Handbook. but it's green, and it was in the hard copy, so we call it green because we don't like having so many things to say. Because all the graphs, apart from smallpox and TB in the Green Book, start in about the 1940s. So I rang up our Office for National Statistics, and I said, hello, could I have the graphs for all the deaths from all the diseases against which we vaccinate since we've been collecting the records? And they said, well, we've got them for smallpox and TB, but the other ones start in the 40s. And I said, yeah, well, I know I've got them. I've got them in the Green Book. I want for all the other ones. They said, well, contact the Department of Health. So I rang them up, and they said the same thing, apart from opposite. They said, contact the Office for National Statistics. So I thought, this is a bit circular. So I rang them back, and I said, you must have all the data. And they said, oh, yes, it's here on the shelves in the books. You can come in and, you know, take the books off the shelves and write them down. So I said, okay. Luckily, then they were based in Pimlico in London, because I'm based in London and not in Cardiff or Swansea or wherever they are now. So I went in there with my children, who by then were about 6 and 4, and I pulled out all the moss with lots of crayons and drinks and stuff to it. And I thought to myself, why am I going with my toddlers into this national reference library? There are all these people doing BSCs and MSCs and PhDs. Why haven't they done the graphs? Anyway, I went in, I pulled all the books off the shelf, I wrote down the figures, and then thankfully from 1900 onwards, I put them in from 1837 till 1899. Then after that, there's a really user-unfriendly, expensive CD-ROM that you could take home. But at least you could take it home and fight with it without having your toddlers in the National Reference Library. And I did graphs, which I haven't got to show to you today, actually. But basically, they say what you're saying, which is you have deaths from measles, and it goes down to almost 100% reduction before the vaccine's introduced. I mean, there were deaths, and the same with whooping cough. And so when you look at these, you say to yourself, well, whether you think vaccinations are a good idea or whether you think vaccinations are not a good idea, you have to see that something other than vaccinations and antibiotics, which didn't come until the 40s in the war, something other than that was making stupendous numbers of people not die anymore.
Right. So,
and what is that? Well, it's sanitation. Because what do you need to be healthy? You need clean water, adequate food, ventilated housing, fresh air, sunshine, and someone to love and look after you. And in many cases, there are parents who try and love and look after their children in very difficult circumstances. But if you're drinking sewage and you're on the edge of starvation and you live in a damp, mouldy, horrible place where the sewage is dripping through your walls because you're in a basement, or you've got 14 people, one of my father's cousins, she worked in the Dublin Housing Department at the end of the war, and she said they had a celebration when they had rehoused all the 13 people in one-room families. You know, this is not 13 people in a house with one bedroom. This is 13 people in one room. And that's why when people used to say to me, oh, you know, children need their own room and this and that and the other, I said, this is how people used to live. And they actually produced fine individuals against all the odds. So it's not space that people need. It's time. It's like having their mum there, maybe.
Well, also Stumpet City, if anyone reads that, there's the horrifying death of rashers in the cellar. I don't know if you remember that.
Yes,
but so fast forward to, was it 2002 when you were hauled up in front of the General Medical Council?
2002 is when I first got into trouble. And the trouble was, I was asked by two mothers who were not related, but their cases had been put together, to be their expert. These were two mothers who didn't want to vaccinate their children. And the two fathers who didn't live with them, or pay any money for them, interestingly, were so interested in their welfare that despite not worrying about whether there's food in their bellies or a shirt on their back or a roof over their head, they really thought that it was important that the children were vaccinated. And initially, the Legal Aid Board would not pay for an expert on their side. Not that experts are supposed to take sides. Experts are supposed to produce evidence.
Yeah.
And because they said there wouldn't be one. And the mothers managed to find people in the UK that they weren't doctors, and that the Legal Aid Board said they have to be a doctor. So they found doctors in America, but they said no, they have to be registered in the UK. So then they found me, and being Irish and having been oppressed for 800 years, I have an understanding of what it's like to be oppressed. Okay, so I thought, these poor women, you know, somebody needs to say, not be on their side, but actually show that there's some science behind what they're saying, because they weren't doing it. Well, one particularly one was not doing it from a scientific point of view. She came from about four or five generations of not being vaccinated. So that's just what they did. That was their family. That was their, you know, that was their culture, which we're supposed to be protecting. It's supposed to be, I think, a protected characteristic and a human right, so long as it doesn't interfere with what other people want you to do. And so I decided I'd take it on. And I looked at the reports by the father's expert and the expert for the children, because if you're a minor, you get your own team. And basically, they're about three pages long with no references that said the diseases all kill you, the vaccines are safe and effective, you should have all the vaccines. And the expert for the fathers was even recommending that the older child, who was about four, should have vaccines that weren't even listed in the schedule for four-year-olds. He was so keen on vaccines. So I thought, how's the judge going to see that there is a reasonable point of view that's different to what they're saying? So I saw what they said. It was a bit like what, except less, a bit like what it says in all the leaflets you get handed out by the NHS or your GP. And so I thought, I need to put a balancing thing here. So I thought, I'll tell a story. And stories are not necessarily made up. Stories are how we understand everything. Everything in our life we learn through stories. So I thought, I'll put the story of the disease. So what the disease is, what happens when you get it, how many people actually get clinical disease, what was happening to the disease in terms of death and disability before the vaccines were introduced, and what was happening after, what the manufacturers say is in the vaccines and what they say are the adverse reactions, and what the likelihood of a child that has access to what we'd call the normality in a developed country like clean water and so on would have of either getting the disease or having a bad outcome if they had it. You know, is it, can you nurse people through it? So I did that, and everything was fully referenced. As it turned out, the judge didn't like what I said. The two other experts were consultants in hospitals. They were also members of the Joint Committee on Vaccination and Immunisation. So that was a big conflict of interest, because if they said the children shouldn't be vaccinated, they'd be talking against themselves. But my final outcome with producing all this evidence was that basically, if two parents live together and they have children and they can't agree, they split up and they can't agree, it should be the person, whichever parent has day-to-day care, who should make the decision, whatever it is, because they're the people who are going to have to manage the person, whatever the choice, whatever the decision is. But anyway, so they didn't like it, and the judge threw out my evidence, and then it went to appeal. And at appeal, one of the judges called it junk science. And on the basis of that, the General Medical Council, there was no outside complainer, it was the General Medical Counsellor, Saul, who decided to accuse me of serious professional misconduct. In fact, the complainant was listed as newspaper clipping. And that was in 2004, because the main hearing was in 2002, then there was the appeal in 2003, and then they accused me in 2004, about the same month, February, as they accused Dr. Andrew Wakefield. And it dragged on for about 3 years. And first of all, my medical defence people, we pay vast amounts of money to indemnify us in case patients complain. But basically, I've only ever been complained about by the GMC and other doctors. So for these types of things. Anyway, so they thought I was a bit bonkers, but otherwise quite harmless. And I was never stopped from practicing until they got the report from the GMC's expert, who was a Dr. David Ellerman, who at that time was a consultant at Great Ormond Street, you know, the premier children's hospital, and immunisation coordinator for Islington. And they said in all the time that they'd been defending doctors, they'd never ever seen a report by an expert about a professional colleague that was so critical and so scathing. And as he was so eminent and I was so not eminent, the panel wouldn't fail to be swayed by him. So they would find me guilty of all the charges, except they'd done a deal for me, which was that all I had to do was agree to all the charges, things like quoting wrongly and being mixed up and confused and not following my duty as an expert, and worst of all, allowing my my views on immunisation and vaccination to override my duty to the court to give an independent, objective and unbiased view. So they said I just had to agree to all of those, and then they'd get me to keep my registration. Well, I don't know if that would have ever happened, but I can tell you, 3 years in, this sort of thing really wrecks your life. If you want to know why doctors don't speak out, this is like a day-to-day thing. Already I was bringing up two children on my own, trying to work, trying to support them, and this thing just was horrendous. And the number of nights I didn't get any sleep as I had to sit there just going through stacks and stacks of things, because somebody who's quoting what the Department of Health says just has to quote the Department of Health. If you want to go into that, you have to get references from all around the world. And you know, it was just horrendous. So, but on the other hand, I said to them, hang on a minute, because the thing that's always been most important to me, as I told you, is not my registration, but my reputation. Because what's the point of being registered if they think you're that bonkers woman who doesn't know what she's talking about? So I said I'd like a second opinion. And at that point, about 3 weeks before the case, they said, well, if you want to stand on your soapbox and beat your drum, you can do that, but we're not going to support you. So they left me with no lawyer and no barrister and nobody before the case 3 weeks before. And I managed to find an amazing person called Mr. Clifford Miller, solicitor, who thankfully they did say they would pay for. And he managed to find a brilliant barrister called Mr. Ian Stern. And he managed to get it adjourned from the December to the following August. It's very interesting, actually. I was home educating my children, which is another story we'll talk about another time, and they wanted me to have a case in June, and I live in London. I was single parent bringing up my children. The GMC was based in London, but they have offices in Manchester, so they wanted me to go to Manchester for 3 weeks, just in case you're wondering why people don't want to open their mouths. And if I had taken out the wrong kidney and the person had died, they probably have done my case in about 3 or 4 days. But for my case, where the essence was that if two parents can't agree, it should be the person with day-to-day care who makes the decision, it was 3 weeks. And in order not to have it in June, which was in the middle of some of the GCSEs my children were doing, I had to get a letter from the local authority saying I'd be in dereliction of my duty as a home educating parent to leave my children. And the GMC was saying, oh, but it's just revision. They don't need you there. I mean, not even be there during the day, because I was in Manchester and they were down here. Anyway, that's how it was. But in the end, to cut a long story, which is already a bit long short, after 3 weeks in Manchester, the panel decided, and I still can't quite believe it, that they threw out all the charges. They said I wasn't guilty of any of them, and they said that in the reports I produced I hadn't failed to be independent, objective and unbiased, and that was beyond any doubt, although they used the word sure, which is yes, that's, they were sure, because they used to say, you know, they say beyond any doubt, but they've now changed that wording to sure. We are sure you didn't fail to be independent, yes, objective and unbiased. Yeah, so that's it. And I think I had about 9 years being free of being hounded by the GMC, and then all the complaints started again. And I got a whole load of complaints now since December 2019, because early in 2019, they sent out some journalists from the Times and Telegraph to attend lectures and try and ask questions that they would get. Well, in fact, one of them, it took 4 lectures to get the answers he wanted.
Hold on a sec. Lectures on what?
Oh, I lecture about vaccination. I lecture about how to treat fevers. I lecture about MMR.
Oh, just your lectures?
Just my lectures, yeah. And another one came along pretending to be a patient asking about vaccination. And so, you know, sins like, for example, in an ideal world, girls would get mumps, and girls and boys would get mumps, and girls would get rubella because it would be longer lasting in an ideal world. But you're not allowed to say that, even though we don't live in an ideal world. You're not allowed to say things like that, even though it's the truth, because it's not about truth, it's about towing the party line. And I was told in November 2019 by a deputy director of medicine at the NHS England that basically if there's a conflict between the best interest of the patient and NHS policy, and we weren't talking about a funding decision because these are hard decisions that have to be made, but basically if there is a conflict between the best interest of the patient and NHS policy, if you want to work in the NHS you have to follow NHS policy, which is not what I signed up for.
No, well, I have friends who are doctors. I think what you're illuminating is something really frightening, which is that doctors can't actually treat their patients without, in the manner that they wish to. I listened to the interview you did with, what's his name?
Richie Allen.
The very man, yes. Sorry, Richie. Yeah. And no, but what interested me was him saying that, or somebody said, I don't know if it was you, about being prescribed vitamins and so on. And I thought, well, my doctor prescribed me with vitamin B12, I'm delighted to say, and is, you know, doing that, you know, I'm quite happy with my doctor, in other words.
Yeah.
But it does I mean, I'm sure everybody now who kind of knows, I mean, we've been discussing this among ourselves in the Irish Inquiry, that we know what's going on. How do we get it through to people? And the big questions a lot of people have are, if this is the case, if in fact it's only a synthetic virus, it's not novel or anything like that, the test is a joke, as we all know.
Sad joke.
The experimental injection is what we call it on this program, so we don't get banned, is just completely unnecessary. But what people are saying, when you try and argue with them, as I'm sure you know, they say, well, then how come the medical profession is supporting this?
Okay, so there are two things. One is, not every doctor is cowering behind the fact that they don't want to lose the payments for their mortgage, and that they really know what is the right thing, but they're not doing it because they have to follow government policy. The vast majority of doctors are like I was before I started looking into vaccination. I thought vaccination, or not, maybe I'm not supposed to use the V word, I thought it was the best thing since sliced bread. I that's what I thought. I used to really look down on people who didn't want to vaccinate. I thought I was very superior and arrogant in that respect, because I knew that I knew better. My one saving grace is that I have a tremendous thirst after knowledge, and I'm a slightly controversial person in that I like to read things that I don't agree with. Because on the one hand, you can sort of sit there feeling very superior, thinking, well, that's wrong, and that's wrong, and that's wrong. But when you read things you don't agree with, you sometimes find these things, and you think, really? That can't be the case. And you look it up, and lo and behold, it is the case. Like, for example, the whole thing to do with the vaccination. I mean, I knew that everybody stopped dying because it showed me that in the Green Book. But then I looked at these other things, and I didn't believe them. But so I had to go and look for it myself. And what I don't understand about doctors in terms of this whole V procedure is that it's not just now it's become controversial. People talk about, oh, you know, there's these middle-class Chardonnay-swigging mothers who do lunch, and they don't want little Tarquin and Cressida to have a vaccine, and they don't care about everybody else, you know. It's not. And they say if they knew what it was like before the vaccines were introduced, there were people lying dead in the street. And they just don't realise that they're riding on the back of all those other people who are having them. Well, back in the 19th century, people were lying dead in the street. They were lying dead in the street from starvation and typhoid and typhus and tuberculosis. And with those people lying dead in the street, there was this enormous, tremendous backlash of people not wanting to have that smallpox vaccine. You know, the people were lying dead in front of them and they didn't want to have it. Many didn't want to have it because they said, I don't want pus put into my child. Many people didn't want to have it because people in those days, as a majority, were more spiritual than they are now. They looked at the spiritual aspect and they said, we're not spiritually designed as humans who were uniquely human to have the spiritual products of an animal put in them. That's how they saw it. That was their objection. There wasn't a medical objection. And that's why it was so difficult to get the smallpox rates of vaccine up. They had to make them compulsory, and then even that didn't work. They had to make them enforced, and there were all these parents being taken and fined. You know, if you had 8 children and you refused vaccination, they'd fine you about a month's wages. And then, so if you had 8 children, that was 8 months. So there you went. You had no money. You were in the jail, and then your wife and children ended up in the poorhouse. And yet they still fought. And in the end, they eventually repealed it. But when they enforced vaccination, a bit like they're doing now in 1867, the death rate from smallpox zoomed up in the air, because smallpox vaccine is a live vaccine.
Yeah.
Just like the AstraZeneca version is a live vaccine. It's a live vaccine. And when I looked at the reports at the Office for National Statistics, they used to have smallpox deaths vaccinated, smallpox deaths unvaccinated, and vaccinia deaths. Vaccinia is whatever the thing is that's in the smallpox vaccine. And there were lots of vaccinated deaths. And in the end, what they did was they amalgamated them so you couldn't see. And that continues to today. You have a measles outbreak somewhere, and you say, so how many people were not were vaccinated? We don't have that information. Why not? Oh, because the parents can't remember. Well, you know, we're talking about a controversial vaccine in the last 2 or 3 years, not a vaccine 20 years ago. And anyway, it's on all the GP computers. So how can you say that? Because that's why people get all these phone calls and texts and letters. So what do you mean you don't know? And when you, if you actually report an infectious reportable disease, apart from in about one borough, there's no question that says, have they had the vaccine for it? So what I don't understand, because people who question vaccination and try and try to fulfil their legal and ethical duty to get informed consent are always called, non-science quacks and whatever. I'd never understand quite how non-scientific the whole process is of this, because, and even from the economic point of view, they don't cost nothing. They cost a lot of money. They cost money to buy. They cost money to administer. All those clinics, all those letters, all those texts, all those follow-ups, all those needles, all those syringes, the trucks trucking them around the country. You want to know if it's worth your investment. So you obviously want to know every time someone is diagnosed with, say, measles, yeah, or COVID, whether they've had the vaccine for it. So why is the question not on the form?
Well, should the state have any involvement in any of this anyway, I would ask myself.
No, they shouldn't, because our bodies are sovereign. And there was a marvellous, wonderful man. Was he called? I can't remember his name now. Was it McGraw? A dentist? No, he wasn't. Sorry, he was a hockey player. A hockey player in Ireland who resigned from being a hockey player for the Irish team because he said he's not going to represent a country anymore that is dividing the country in half and practising apartheid.
And he said,
our freedom is not given by the government, it is given by God. He said, and even if you don't have to believe in God to realise that's the truth. And these governments have decided that they are God and that they are the people who grant us our freedoms. On the 19th of this month, people were saying, we got our freedoms back. I said, nobody took our freedom away. We gave up our freedom because it's not the government's place. They don't have the power to take our freedom away. They just do it if we let them.
We could talk for hours, and I'm kind of conscious that you have places to go, and so do I. What do we do?
Well, with all of these things, if you try and take on too much, it's a bit like being a doctor. If you want to try and heal everybody and stop everybody's pain, you'll end up throwing yourself off the Bristol suspension bridge.
Yes.
You know, all you can do is one step at a time. I think that's the words of a song. And you can just try and protect yourself and your own. And even your own are quite hard, because within families, it's like the Civil War. Families are split, you know. So all you can do really is try and look after yourself and try and be true to yourself and try and, remember that your freedom is your freedom and it's not for someone to give or take away. And I keep remembering the three great lies that keep going through my mind, which is, you know, I really love you, the check's in the post, and I'm a government official and I'm here to help you.
Do you know what? We could talk for hours, but I think Stephen would be never going to shut up. So yeah. I think we'll end it here, but hopefully, there's a word that I'm not supposed to use. I hope that we can speak again, and there's a few other topics that you mentioned that I'd love to pursue in greater depth at a later stage. So thank you, Dr. Jane, for
thank
a very
you.
Illuminating chat, and hopefully, I shouldn't say hopefully once again, I hope that we will chat again.
Yes, please, God.
Thank you, Jane, for a revealing look into the world of vaccinations, and we hope we can chat again soon. Don't forget that the Healthy Debate is brought to you by a team of volunteers, in this case, Stephen and myself, as it happens. If you want to support what we're doing, we won't say no to a few bob, and you can find the donate button on the Irish Inquiry website. Good night, and see you next week.